Sports Radio 610 presents Area 45 with Bijani and Creighton.
9 o'clock hour, Sean Bijani, Patrick Creighton, Mitch Millimacki with you. We're Area 45 tonight. Couple more hours to go before we can officially start our weekend. Hopefully you're enjoying yours. Just told PC, man, hell of a crowd at Daikin Park tonight. Holiday weekend. It's as it should be, PC. I mean, the stadium looks nice and full. Going to have a little Friday night fireworks, win or lose later tonight. That's going to be good. The Astros right now doing enough to very much win this ball game. They are leading 3-2. Jose Altuve trying his damnedest tonight at the plate and in the field to make sure that that happens. He's got a two-hit night to his name so far for Jose Altuve, coming off of a two-homer game last night, but just did something that you say was the second time tonight. Or the second time this season that he's done, or is it officially the first? Had an outfield assist from left field.
It's at least his second, but this is the first time Altuve has cut a guy down at the plate.
Yeah.
And the coffee sippers sent big dumper, Cal Raleigh, tried to score him from second on a single to left, and Jose Altuve cut him down.
They, like,
by a mile.
I don't know what the third base coach was doing.
They an Altuve can't throw.
Or if Cal Raleigh took it upon himself to do it. But he was just beyond the cutout at third base before Altuve had fielded that hop and put his glove, like the ball met glove. He was just outside of the cut. He was going. Like, no matter what, like if it's third base call or if it's Cal Raleigh's call, that dude was going. It wasn't even close. Now, not to take anything away from Jose Altuve, that was a really good throw. It was a one hopper to the plate, right on line. It didn't have that, you know, that pop to it. Like when it hits the ground, like does it, you know, it has that top spin that just gets to the catcher. But it was on line. It was a really good throw by Jose Altuve. So that's awesome. I don't know that he will soon find his way atop the list for weighted runs created for left fielders.
Well, that'd be outs above average or defensive run saved.
Yeah, but they just showed the graphic of Jake Meyers up there, weighted runs created plus.
Well, that's offense.
It's an
offensive stat.
Yeah, but Jake Meyers is doing things defensively and offensively. So, like, what would you call that? Like, war, I guess, collectively, what you do defensively and offensively.
So, Jake Meyers just got caught stealing second base.
Yeah.
And then Cam Smith bangs a single to right, which would have put Meyers at second.
Yeah.
So, instead of having first and second, nobody out, there's running first and one out.
Oh, you got to pick on Jake tonight because Marisnik got thrown out not once but twice earlier. In the week, I believe. I think it was in the Rangers series, maybe on Sunday.
McCormick.
Yeah. Didn't I?
You said Marisnik.
Oh, whatever. McCormick. Come on, you know what I'm talking about. But, you know, Altuve tonight, you got to give him credit. Like, maybe this guy's definitely back now. Like, he's making things happen in the field, making things happen at the plate.
Hey, he's playing left field, and he's 3-for-3.
Oh, he's got three hits tonight. Maybe this, I think this has to definitely squash, like, my theory of him needing to, like, get back in the flow of things and play second base, get his mind right, familiar territory. Like, he played there, what, 5 times in 10 games time. Maybe 3 days in a row at second base did he start before Espada put him back in left field. And yesterday had the 2-home run game from left field. Tonight, 3-hit performance from left field, and he gets a... It's not an out above average, I would say, but it was a good play. Cut a runner down at the plate, kept the lead for your team, so that's pretty dang good. 713-572-4610, 572-4610.
Will there be crawfish like in your weekend?
I don't know. I haven't decided yet. What about? I know it's not going to be crawfish for you unless it's an etouffee or somebody peels it for you.
No, I had
bougie ass.
I had multiple etouffees while my... father-in-law was in town.
That's right. You say you had leftovers, too.
Yeah. So I kind of got my crawfish fill, but I'm always down for some shrimp or scallops or something like that.
Dude, scallops is one thing I always forget. I always forget. And they're so cheap at the grocery store.
Sea scallops, not bay scallops. Always get sea scallops.
What's the difference?
Bigger.
Oh, bigger.
They taste better.
Okay, yeah.
Bay scallops are them little baby-sized ones, whereas the sea scallops are big ones.
Oh, yeah, no. Yeah, it's definitely the big ones, the way to go. I guess like the small ones you would put in, you would prepare and throw them into something with some, you know, and eat it with something else.
Yeah.
Like, so the sea scallops are the big ones.
Get the sea scallops.
I never remember to get those. They're so easy to do.
Oh, they're so good.
Do you put those on like in the cast iron, or do you throw them on the grill?
Put them on a grill.
Really? That is all you do.
I grill everything. I have a cast iron pan that goes on the grill. I have copper mats that go on the grill.
Well, there you go.
I have a basket that folds over that goes on the grill. Dude, I have so many tools.
I mean, if you're using the cast iron, though, you might as well use it on the stove. That's the only place I know how to do scallops. I figured like you're getting the big ones and you got like a thin grate.
I actually use the basket for the scallops the same way I use it for the shrimp, and this way I can marinate them and then turn them over. And
you get like the grill marks on them if you use the basket too, I guess. Yeah, but good job by you.
The basket is really good.
I don't know what the hell I'm going to do for food this weekend. I know I feel like I owe myself a really good meal. I haven't had one of those yet in a very, very long time. So steak, crawfish, seafood. If it's just a hot dog and a hamburger, I will be severely disappointed.
Dude, that'd be like a Monday thing.
Yeah.
Because the reality is you and I are going to be here on Monday because mm-hmm. Ron, Clint, lazy. So you and I will be doing the drive on Monday. So it'll be an Area 45 drive.
Very excited about not having to be somewhere other than home or wherever else I want to be at night. Not that I don't enjoy being here most nights, because I do. It's fun. But Monday, holiday.
Holiday, we get to get home a little early.
Glad you don't have to be, quote-unquote, working.
See, and that's the day that you go home and you make burgers and dogs, because you're going to get home at 7 o'clock. Like, all right, let me turn on the grill, make some burgers and dogs.
Don't want
go.
To. If I grill, it's got to be like around 5 o'clock.
Don't make me hungry.
7 o'clock, I want to sit, chill, watch a ball game, watch a race, do something.
And 7 o'clock is when it's nice outside. You can actually sit outside.
Nah.
Crack a beer, put the TV on outside, and you're...
I need a TV for outside, for one. Don't have one of those yet.
Well, here's a crazy thing, right? So, your TV usually has, your modem into it, so you can wirelessly connect it. So all you got to do is take it outside,
and
you can put it on.
You
don't have like a, say a rando 38-inch, 40-inch TV that you can just put outside.
I mean, I could unplug said TV from living room or bedroom and take it outside, but then that would involve me taking it back inside, plugging it in, and I don't want to go through all that crap.
That's a lot of fun. Come on.
No, it's extra work.
I'll do it for you.
You could buy like a 40-inch TV right now for probably like $99.
I know. That's a lot of money. I'm going to have to do that, actually.
Life hack. Buy it. Use it. Return it.
Then I can't use it again.
That's even a more pain in the ass. This is spoken like somebody that is not married with no kids. It doesn't have
you
other
could probably
things
to get absolutely. One on Amazon for like $69 too.
Yeah, it's
and
money.
You just put it outside under your overhang, and you put it outside, and you got the TV on while you're grilling, sitting down, having a beer, hanging out outside, just relaxing, throw a ball for the dog. Wait, you don't have.
They need to let me work 3 more hours of radio to pay for that, bro. So there's that. I need to make that happen, and I don't know if I'll be able to do that between now and then. Nah, it's all good. 3-2 Astros on top. Top 7. One out, one on. Brian King on the mound for the Stros. Some familiar faces on the mound tonight that we saw, I think, even last night. Brian King included.
So, Jose Altuve's throw to the plate. 85.5 miles per hour.
No way.
Yeah?
Really?
85.5 miles
I don't know what
hour.
To say to that, really.
For Jose Altuve.
That's the... From the last time I checked his StatCast, I think it was like 84. So you said 85.
85.5.
So it's probably a season high, unless I've missed something between the last time and now.
Probably a season high.
I mean, that's not a great arm, but it's respectable for him. I mean, that's right around what Chaz McCormick, Jake Myers sport. Maybe theirs is a little bit higher, like 87. Maybe they hit 88 for a max. Velo for them. I mean, that's really good. It was a very good throw. It just,
And it was on target.
It was on target. That's the most important thing. But if that was on turf, maybe it has that, you know, maybe it has that little top spin. Once it hits the turf, just boom, it kind of shoots a little bit faster to the catcher. But I'm not going to complain. That at the very least, teams are going to look at that and be like, okay, Cal Raleigh's fat ass, Seattle Mariners, third base coach, ill-advised in sending him. Now you kind of have a floor. if you're the Astros and Jose Altuve, like, you know when they're probably not going to send this guy. But I do think Altuve's going to have to do that again. He's going to have to do it again and again, you know, because I think it's not even just like the arm strength. It's the accuracy for him that they're going to test. They're going to test the accuracy. How often is he going to make that throw in the neighborhood where Caratini or Diaz can handle it and get that guy out?
I mean, it was really basically the Mariners saying Jose Altuve couldn't throw out a freaking slug.
Yeah, 100%.
Well, he threw out big dumper.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and who's going to be the next team to make a poor decision? It's probably going to give him a little bit of pause. That's the whole idea. That's why it's a big play for Altuve and the Astros. Big payday for Brock Purdy over the course of the past week. $181 million guaranteed. He got his deal finally from the San Francisco 49ers. Not irrelevant anymore. In fact, very, very relevant. How relevant to the Texans and C.J. Stroud? That's like the next obvious question. What does that contract mean for C.J. Stroud? I don't think I talked to you about this, actually. Maybe I talked to Chris Partee about it because I think it happened while you were out. Do you think one has something to do with the other? Or is C.J. Stroud's contract going to come down to more so like Dak Prescott, highest paid quarterback in the NFL, average annual value, $60 million per year? Mind you, when C.J. Stroud is eligible for his extension, it'll be this time next offseason, whatever kind of money he gets for however long, PC, it's not going to kick in until 2028. So how relevant actually is Brock Purdy's contract to the Texans and C.J. Stroud, in your opinion?
Well, look, it's always about who's next. And if C.J. has a big season this year, at his rookie season last year, he was completely under siege. And I do think that his agent will very much bring up the fact that he played on average with more pressure than Patrick Mahomes played in the Super Bowl. And Mahomes had the worst game of his life.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when you consider CJ kind of survived and held his own while under just relentless pressure all year long.
Yeah.
That Mahomes couldn't handle for one day.
Yeah.
So if CJ then comes out and has a big season this year, he's going to get all the dollars.
Mm-hmm.
But I did think it was, because, you know, you look at Brock's deal, right? It's 5 years, $265 million. That is a $53 million AAV.
Mm-hmm.
That's a whole lot of money.
That puts him, like, I think, tied for sixth in highest paid quarterbacks in the NFL in terms of AAV. I think he's tied with Tua, if not slightly ahead or behind. But he's definitely, at this point in time, top 10. He's top 10 paid quarterback in the NFL. C.J. Stroud is going to be a top 10 paid quarterback in the NFL in terms of AAV. C.J. Stroud, maybe not from a fully guaranteed standpoint, but in total monies, like guarantees, I mean, he might crack top three.
So Dak is $60 million.
Mm-hmm. AAV, yes.
Josh Allen's 55. Burrow is 55.
Allen's a very new contract as well.
Trevor Lawrence is 55.
Mm-hmm.
Jordan Love is 55.
Already got his, yep.
Tua is 53.1. Purdy is 53. Goff is 53. Herbert, 52.5. Lamar, 52. Boy, is he underpaid. Jalen Hurts, 51. Kyler Murray, 46. And then Deshaun Watson, 46. CJ is going to get more than Brock Purdy, and Brock Purdy just got $53 million.
Yeah. Well, I think there's a chance that C.J. Stroud gets more than Dak Prescott.
Ah, crap.
Yeah, it's a 3-run homer.
Ryan Abreu comes in and serves up a 3-run bomb.
But I think there's a chance C.J. gets more than Dak Prescott.
It hit the pole.
Yeah. His new contract's not kicking in until 2028. So here's Dak Prescott, who just got this deal before this past season at $60 million per. C.J. Stroud's going to get his after
this season.
After this season.
That but would what kick does in that 2 season, years later.
Exactly. What does one this season look like? And then that new money is not going to kick in for another 2 seasons in 2028. So C.J. Stroud, like when somebody said, boy, after Dak signed his deal, Stroud, maybe he's a $70 million a year player. I don't know that it's really that far off. Like maybe it's a little bit closer to 65, 63, but I feel very confident it's going to be more. C.J. Stroud for a month, for a year, 14 months, I don't know, is going to be the highest paid quarterback in the NFL for a period of time. You can almost book that.
Yeah, I feel like it's going to be like $64
million. Yeah, unless C.J. Stroud, if C.J. Stroud has a year closer to the one that he just had, versus the one that he had his rookie season, I don't even know that it matters. I don't even know that, like, from a results standpoint, like personal statistics, because as bad as we're talking about the Texans' offensive being, the offensive line being, the injuries costing them from a receiver standpoint last year, they still won 10 games. They won a division. And it was with C.J. Stroud, fully healthy all year long. If he has a year this upcoming season comparable to the one that he and the Texans just came off of, he's still going to get all the dollars, in my opinion.
And when you think about it, how much pressure he is constantly, and not just he's under pressure, but he's under immediate pressure where he can't finish his drop and there's pressure up the middle.
Yeah.
Like, we're not even talking about pressure off the edge. CJ's pressure was coming straight up the middle. Like, there's nowhere to go.
Yeah.
And if he still winds up taking the team to the postseason and winning a playoff game, he's getting all the dollars.
All the dollars, man.
And you know what? There will be some firings on the offensive line. And
as there should be.
They might be some, you know, they might have another new offensive line coach. But.
Well, and that, I think Clint Sterner's been saying it. The singular guy in the entire organization that is under the most pressure is Cole Popovich. And I don't know how you could really disagree with that, because that is the one guy on that side of the ball that had fielded, that was, you know, positionally responsible for the most criticism. He was an assistant O-line coach, and they kept him and they promoted him. And I'm assuming by many of his recommendations or co-signings that they brought in Ingram and Tomlinson and Trent Brown and Cam Robinson and the holdovers, whether it be Scruggs or Patterson or Howard, whatever iteration of the offensive lineman, Eli Cox, who they brought in, as well as undrafted free agent, I believe. Like, whatever he decides, if it doesn't work, if there are having to be wholesale changes throughout the first month or couple of months of the season, like, yeah, there's not going to be questions that he's going to be around to answer. I don't know that there are even questions. I think there are decisions being made, and it's, you got to get the hell out. But then the Texans have to finally make a damn decision, but have a proper evaluation of who the hell are they going to hire that can actually coach an offensive line for longer than a year with success?
You know, look, when you keep bringing in these coulda, woulda, shouldas on the offensive line, if you've got to fire the offensive line coach again, then they really need to take a look at what they're doing on the offensive line, because this will be, what, 3 offensive line coaches in 5 years? Mm-hmm. And every year the line is just worse and worse and worse. Like they have to get it right this year. And a lot of that's on Cole Popovich, but some of that's also on Nick Caserio. And if they fail again this year, there's got to be a going back to the drawing board of how do we evaluate offensive line.
Yeah, well, I think it's very much on Nick Caserio, too, because it appears that he's got his hands in offensive decision-making more this year than anything ever before in terms of, like, personnel acquisition. There's just too many things that connect to the New England, you know, way, whether it be Nick Haley, Cole Popovich, offensive linemen.
Because I don't think Cal's going to make changes as far as GM and the head coach. But the GM and the head coach, it's going to be on them to make whatever changes need to be made.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I definitely think if there's anybody that would be quote-unquote untouchable, at least for the next 12 months, it'd be D'Amico Ryans, for sure. 713-572-4610 if you want to hop on. We'll update
D'Amico
you on Astros.
D'Amico could walk out in the middle of Main Street and drop his pants. He's not getting fired.
I don't know about that, but I see your point. If he did the latter, there would be a lot of questions that he would have to answer. More Area 45 coming up next. So the Mariners lead the Astros 5-3, bottom seven. Stros have a man on with two out in Christian Walker at the plate, who is 0-2 this evening, trying to make something happen for the Astros to get back in this ballgame. Brian Abreu, according to Matt Kawahara of the Houston Chronicle, covers the Astros, had allowed just three extra base hits all season long entering play tonight. Gave up a double to Julio Rodriguez and then gave up a home run to Cal Raleigh. So he's now got five extra base hits allowed on the season. But that Cal Raleigh homer, PC, was the first dinger Abreu had allowed all season long.
You're not going to believe this.
Hmm.
The Knicks are down by 10 with under 2.5 minutes to go. They're about to go down 0-2 at home.
I wouldn't have necessarily trouble believing that. Pacers are a good basketball team.
But
man,
a game after they blew a 17-point lead with 6.5 minutes to go, they come out in the next game in their own building, and they're just getting taken to the woodshed the fourth quarter again.
It's an 8-point game right now, 110-102, 150 remaining in the fourth quarter. Jalen Brunson's 31, Cat's got 20, Bridges has 20 for the Knicks. The Pacers, Pascal Siakam, hot, 39 points, man. They've got six dudes in double figures, all five of their starters included. They have been hitting the three, and the Knicks have not been doing that near enough. Knicks are 10 of 29, Pacers are 13 of 29. We'll see what happens. Now it's a 5-point game. So PC trying to reverse psychology the Knicks back into this ball game. We've seen far stranger things have happening. The Pacers did become a 1-of-1 the other night on the positive side, the glass half full side, and the Knicks became a 1-of-1 on the other end of the spectrum in terms of biggest fourth quarter leads blown in NBA playoff history. We'll see if the Knicks have a little magic in their bloodstream tonight and maybe can come back. I said 5 points. Oh, it's 3 points. We've had a conversation now about this for less than a minute, and it's gone from 10 to 5 to now 3, and there's still a minute 5 remaining in the fourth quarter, PC. Let's go. Let's go. We'll be all negative and stuff. Holy crap, dude. Ocho texted in during the break. PC, Brock Purdy might cook this season because the Niners have the easiest strength of schedule. How much stock do you put into strength of schedule as it equates to probable success for a team?
With the Niners, not much. Because the issue with the Niners is injuries.
Mm-hmm.
The issue with the Niners is, you know, who's going to stay healthy.
Right. But I'm talking about in general. Like, is that something you generally subscribe to?
Not really.
Okay. Here's why I ask you that. According to Sharp Football Analysis, historical data confirms these results year in and year out. The vast majority of teams forecast to have winning records and predicted to have easier than average schedules finish the season with winning records. 11 of 14 such teams in the last 2 years have had winning records. The vast majority of teams forecast to have losing records and predicted to have harder than average schedules finish the season with losing records. 12 of 15 such teams in the last 2 years have had losing records.
But there's a bastardization of that, in that if you are the good team in your division and the other three teams are lousy teams, you have an easy strength of schedule and you finish, you know, with a winning record because you play in a division with three patsies. Well, that's six games out of your season. Same as if you're a patsy in your division, you're going to have a hard strength, the harder strength of schedule because you got to play all these good teams and you're the patsy. So that's six games. You're getting your butt kicked in. So the idea of, you know, oh, well, if you're a good team and you have an easy strength of schedule, well, yeah, because the first part of that is you're a good team.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Niners were a good team, and then they got hurt, and then they had to make changes, right? So no more Deebo Samuel. And Christian McCaffrey, when he plays, they're really good. And when he doesn't play, they're not. Brandon Ayuk is obviously coming off major surgery. And their other receivers are DeMarcus Robinson and Jawan Jennings. Like, that doesn't say cooking to me.
The Niners, according to Vegas, are predicted to win 10.5 games this season. That's the over-under. 10.5 games.
I think that might be high. You're saying that they're going to win 11 games? I think that might be high.
It might be.
The Niners might be closer to 8 or 9 wins.
Here's just one other piece from Sharp Football Analysis. They asked the question, is strength of schedule important? In 2024, just 2 of 10 teams with the toughest schedule made the playoffs. That was the Lions and the Rams. Meanwhile, of the 10 teams with the easiest schedule, 7 produced winning records, with 6 of those 7 with winning records, they made the playoffs. So,
does it say who those teams were?
The 6 that made the playoffs?
Yeah.
No, not directly.
I'm sure one of them is the Buffalo Bills.
10 teams with the easiest schedule, 7 produced. Yeah, so did the Bills have a really easy schedule going into last season? That's what you're saying?
Well,
I don't have that in front of me.
But their division is ass.
Sure, but it could also...
When you think about it, you know, Miami could have been better, but Tua missed so many games, and they lost like every single one of them.
Yeah.
The Jets were ass.
I don't think you're wrong.
The Patriots were ass.
The 2024 Bills schedule was Arizona, at Miami, Jacksonville, at Baltimore, at Houston, at Jets, Titans, Seahawks, Dolphins, at Colts, and then Chiefs.
They played 4 playoff teams.
49ers, at Rams, at Lions, Patriots, Jets, at Patriots. And there you go.
They played 6 playoff teams. They played 11 teams that were lousy.
Mm-hmm. They lost to the Patriots last regular season game. Doesn't count. Lost at the Rams.
Rams are good.
Lost at Texans. Lost at Ravens. So they lost to the Rams. Rams were not a playoff team last year. Rams were 9-8 last year, I do believe, and did not make the playoffs. 9 or 8 or 8 or 9, I can't remember. They lost at least 2 playoff teams. So, I mean, it's not like a world beater schedule. So,
the Rams were a playoff team. They won the division.
What was the record?
10-7.
Oh, 10-7. Okay. So, 3
playoff teams. Seattle was 10-7, and they didn't make the playoffs.
So, they lost to 3 playoff teams.
They lost 3 playoff teams. They lost to the Rams, Texans, and Ravens.
Mm-hmm. I thought it was interesting because I don't always like assuming, hey, you've got the easiest schedule, so you're going to be good.
Like here, example.
How many times have the Texans had an easier schedule?
Because the Giants have to play the Eagles twice, the Commies twice, and the Cowboys twice. So the Giants have a hard schedule because they stink.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, but if you're the Bears.
If they'd finished 9-7, how would you look at that schedule differently for the Giants? Or 9-8 or 10-7?
That'd have been a really good season for them.
Yeah, but how would you look at the schedule? Would you be like, oh, holy crap, that's a really difficult schedule? Or, eh, you know, it's not too bad. That's manageable. It depends on what kind of year they're coming off of. Yeah, the Giants suck.
I think you look at it, you look at their 9-8, then you're look at them and saying, hey, did they overachieve? Or you're saying, hey, did they, you know, blow games they should have won?
Yeah, yeah. Well, and you know, the Niners.
Like if the Eagles went, you know, 10-7, you're like, all right, well, where did they blow some games?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Commies like jumped up and won 12 games. Last year, the Cowboys only won 7 games. Like, okay, why were the Cowboys so bad?
Yeah, yeah. In the Niners' case, I think that's the injury, the health thing. That's it for them because they're really good, you know,
yeah, but
when
keep
they're
in
healthy.
Mind, the Rams and the Seahawks both won 10 games last year, and the Cardinals were 8-9 with a lot of young guys.
And
the Niners are 6-11.
Niners are 6-11
because they didn't have. C-Mac.
What would they have been if they had McCaffrey?
Well,
if Debo
C-Mac,
was healthy,
they,
if
they didn't
Ayuk
have
was healthy.
Brandon Ayuk because he got hurt. So you know this year, well, Ayuk is coming off a major injury. They don't have Debo anymore. McCaffrey is always a walking injury. So this idea that the Niners are just going to win 11 games, like I don't know why they're just going to win 11 games.
I mean, they're betting on a lot. But it's not like crazy bets. They're betting on one, Brock Purdy being a hell of a lot closer to the guy that he was when he led him to the Super Bowl. They're betting
on... They got 1,500 yards from Brandon Ayuk when they went to the Super Bowl.
Well, that's my second point. They're betting on Brandon Ayuk and Christian McCaffrey and Debo Samuel and all of those skills.
Debo's gone.
Yeah, Debo's where now? I forgot where he went. They're betting
Commanders.
On their... Where?
He's Commanders.
The Commanders. They're betting on their skill guys to not... be struck by football Armageddon, you know, which is not a bad bet because, well, how often does that happen to the same guys, like the same guys of importance back-to-back years? I mean, it's still a risky business, but I'm like you. I think 10.5 is a really high number. I would take the under because 10's a really good season. 10 could get the job done in that division. 11 games is a tall task, and San Francisco could still be a threat to a lot of people if they make the playoffs. If they win the division, make the playoffs, they can make a run.
So
we'll see.
I'm going to throw some teams at you in the next segment. We'll use the 11-win benchmarker. You're going to go higher or lower.
That's high, but we'll do it. All right, so you only have to die a death of a minute, of an hour and 15 minutes tonight, PC, after your Knicks have now gone down officially in a 0-2 hole. Pacers beat him tonight, 114-109.
Freaking pathetic.
So your Knickerbockers going to have to pull a Houston Rockets over the Phoenix Suns type of a comeback in a conference final.
How do you totally poop yourself in game one and blow a 17-point lead in under 6.5 minutes? And then game two, when you should be coming out a house of fire, pissed off, looking to slam their heads into the friggin' court. And you're down 10 with 2.5 minutes to go, and you lose by 5. That is friggin' pathetic.
So we didn't really get a chance to get into both sides of this, but we can for a couple minutes. I've been wanting to have this conversation. I told you before the show, I don't expect the Knicks to come in tonight and lay down. A lot of people had the conversation, like the Pacers riding such a high. But, yeah, you just said it. The Knicks... they should have come in tonight with the understanding that, dude, that all happened on our home court. Like, we have to come back and punch them in the throat. We have to come back and play our best basketball tonight and get this dub. But if you look at it from the Pacers' perspective as well, look what you just did and what is one of the more historic rivalries in NBA postseason play. You beat a New York Knicks team at their place, Madison Square Garden, crazy environment. In that fashion, you became a one of one. You could have done one of two things. Like the Knicks could have done one or two things. You Knicks, are they going to roll over? Are they going to get up and fight? Pacers, are they going to come in tonight still high from game one and maybe get throat punched, or they're going to look at this as like, oh yeah, now we smell blood. Now we smell blood. Now we're gonna curb stomp them. We're just gonna be relentless. They overcame a halftime deficit.
No, they were up at half.
No. The Pacers were not up at the half.
Yeah, they were.
No, they weren't. The Pacers were not up at the half. They were down by two. Down by three, excuse me.
They were down by three.
They overcame a halftime deficit, and I don't think they looked back from the first few minutes of the third quarter on. I mean, it was a three-point game, five-point game. When you told me it was a 10-point game, I think that might have been in and around their largest lead. Maybe it got to 12 at some point in time.
There was 2.5 minutes left, 2:25 left to go. They're up by 10.
But that's the one or two things that happened. And I don't know that people probably, you know, gave the Pacers the credit that they deserved for doing what they did in game one. If you weren't convinced after game one, maybe you're convinced now that the Pacers, that's a team to be reckoned with. It's not the big market that you want facing a team like Oklahoma City, which seems like it's well on its way out of the West to NBA Finals. But I think we're seeing the series, albeit 2-0, the types of games that it's exactly what we wanted to see. So outcome in this game, probably not what most people wanted to have happen, but it is pretty damn good drama. It is pretty dang good TV. It's good basketball.
Man, it's a great performance for the Pacers to win both of those games. It is absolutely freaking pathetic for the Knicks to lose two games at home, especially when we historically collapse. It's never been done before. And then the next night, you're not full of you-know-what and vinegar and, mm-hmm. and like, just...
They were 6.5-point favorites coming into the night.
Dude, they nicked. Mm. Just like Chris said.
Yeah.
Chris Bartier said the Knicks were going to nick. They nicked.
Yeah, yeah. So now, down 0-2, you got to go on the road. How you feeling? How you feeling right now if you're a New York Knicks fan?
Well,
do you feel defeated? Do you feel like, you know what? All right, they stole two games on our home court. Now you got to go steal, you know, the first game on their court. And you get back in that series. Now for the Knicks, it becomes literally one game at a time. And I have to say this, you got to break it down even further than that. If you're the Knicks, because of everything that's happened through just the first two games of this series, not only you blew a 17-point lead inside the final 6.5 minutes, whatever it was, in game one, but albeit a very small one, still on your home court and coming off of a dramatic loss as you just did in game one, you drop game two, you got to break this thing down into halves. If you're the New York Knicks, you have to go out there in the first 5 minutes and punch them in the face. You got to win the first half. And more importantly, you have to stave off the Pacers in the second half. Doesn't matter if you win that game by 1 or 21, you got to go win game 3 for the Knicks.
Oh, now you got to go out there and you've basically got to reclaim home court.
Yeah, but I've been saying, yes, that ultimately that's the goal, but you know, you can't hit a 5-run homer. You got to take it, you know, one 5-minute segment at a time if you're the Knicks really at this point in time. You got to win segments of quarters and then halves. And then ultimately the game. It's just, if you're Tom Thibodeau in the Knicks right now, that's how I would be approaching this. That's how I'd be approaching this. The whole piss and vinegar that you should have came out with tonight. You know what? Sometimes, I don't know. We didn't watch the game like thoroughly. It was a close game. It was a close game. Maybe they came out and maybe the New York Knicks played their asses off and the Pacers, they just flexed their muscle, and they were a better team tonight. And I don't know that that wasn't the case for a team that came out and shot 52% for the game, 43% from three, you know, that only turned the ball over 10 times.
Ass.
They got out-rebounded, the Pacers did, by seven.
They got out-rebounded both games, and they got out-shot at the foul line both games.
Yeah.
And the Knicks still find ways to lose.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, it was their ass.
Ass! Free throw line, not a giant disparity tonight. The Knicks, they both took the same amount of free throws, and the Knicks made three more. This game, in terms of, like, box score analysis, came down to the Pacers hitting far more shots than the New York Knicks.
Can't wait for Pacers Thunder in the finals. That'll be watched by less people than are watching Caitlin Clark and the Fever.
Well, I don't know. maybe the few, the proud that will watch will see a hell of a series. I'm trying to look at points in the paint.
Is it a hell 44. Of a series if nobody really watches close. And knows?
That's really close. Yeah. You know, if nobody watches, you know, screw them. You're missing good basketball potentially. What are the ratings like in Minnesota and T-Wolves through the first two games? That's your MVP. That's your league MVP.
Their ass.
And Ant-Man. Yeah, they're I'm sure they are because the game sucked.
You see, that's what irks me sometimes is that people want upsets, but when they get upsets, they're like, bro, no one wants to see this. Like, especially in college basketball, yeah. When Duke loses, when Kentucky loses, be like, yeah, let's go. And then once the Final Four comes around, be like, oh, Houston's in the Final Four. Man, I want to see Duke.
Maybe the first time you and I agree on something. I'm 100% with you. 100% with you. You know, I don't know. I always try to bring it back to stats. Like, how often in NBA does the very best team in the East and the very best team record-wise make it to the NBA Finals?
Not often. It's never like one and one. Like it hardly ever is. Even when it was, you always knew it was going to be Warriors and LeBron. LeBron was hardly ever the one seed in the East.
I looked up these numbers before, and you're right. It rarely happens where those two top teams meet. But there's a better than 75% of the time where at least one of those teams makes it to the NBA Finals. And so from a statistical standpoint, we are already, like, it's absolute fact, you're already going to be disappointed. And you should know you're going to be disappointed by not getting the very best matchup from the proverbial best regular season teams in the NBA Finals. It's not going to happen many more times than not.
I mean, yeah, like I got to completely agree with you there, but not in terms of like a regular season, but once you get to the postseason, I think out of like more than any sport, the best team is usually going to win in the NBA. You look at MLB, there's always upsets. Always upsets.
Who was the best team during the regular season that everybody talked about? Like cross the board, East or West, who was the best team?
Cavs and Thunder.
The best
Thunder.
Team. Thunder. Yeah. Cavs definitely in the conversation. But there was, I think, a huge amount of fans that were like, and we talked about this maybe the other night, you and I, PC, or maybe it was Chris, like, yeah, you know, there's questions about the Cavs. Like, maybe too soon. Maybe too soon.
Yeah,
like,
I know. Chris was already trolling me once they got knocked out.
But dude, like, you're talking about a team that just had a 30-win turnaround from last season to this season. The Rockets, as impressive as they have been, had a 30-win turnaround. It took 2 years for that. They did that in 2 years. The Cavs accomplished it in one. Maybe a little too soon. Maybe they're not exactly ready. Maybe JB Bickerstaff isn't necessarily like ready for this stage for his team. Who knows?
Maybe the Cavs had three key injuries.
Maybe they did. You know, maybe that was everything. And it's certainly something.
But, I mean, you can only say that for the first, like, couple games because Darius Garland and Evan Mobley and all of them, they came back.
That doesn't mean they came back at 100%.
Yeah.
I mean, but you could say, what does everyone say? In the postseason, everybody's injured. So you can't really use that as an excuse.
Yeah,
if you're on the court.
Some people are more injured than others. Yeah. If you're playing on a leg and a half, makes it a little harder to beat a really good team.
Yeah. I mean, soft tissue injury versus that. Like, who was the knucklehead that we talked about the other night? It was like a doubtful because of illness or whatever. It's like they're playing. Come on. It was somebody, Jamal Murray for the Nuggets, went into game 7 is like questionable with the illness. It's like, shut up, dude. He's playing. Like, don't give me this crap. Now, if it's, you know, a strained muscular situation or whatever, like, okay.
It's just like Aaron Gordon played on like a messed up ankle.
Yeah, and it happens. And you know what?
Oh, I think his was hamstring. Yeah, and he couldn't even jump. We saw him playing in game 7. He couldn't even jump.
Yeah.
But I mean, half these people, they'll have a little boo-boo and they'll want to sit out. That's why I don't like the NBA sometimes. Like, that's the difference between college and professional. It's just like people like that, it's just care too much about money sometimes.
Yeah, sometimes. Sometimes. Astros in the bottom of the ninth, now with two outs remaining, trailing 5-3 to the Mariners. So they've got one out, nobody on base. And we'll see if they can pull a little bit of miracle out here. Jose Altuve coming up to the plate for the Astros. He's a really, really good night for him. He's got a 3-for-4 evening. No runs scored, no RBIs, but all he needs to do is kind of set the table for Yiner Diaz and maybe Christian Walker to see if they can come through with a big hit tonight. We'll keep you up to date. Roll into the 10 o'clock hour next. It's Area 45.